Hey, I'm Patrick from the Poison Pen Bookstore in Scottsdale, Arizona, and welcome to another of our virtual events. We're really pleased to have the two authors who write together as Lars Kepler here with us this afternoon. They're going to be talking about the brand new book, The Mirror Man. And then, you know, he agreed to do hosting duties for us, our good friend Brad Thor. This is his latest book, Black Ice. So that's what we've got going on today. And Barbara's going to be, you know, weighing in from home. I'm going to be monitoring the comments and questions, you know, field on YouTube and Facebook. So if you have questions for Lars Kepler or Brad or Barbara, go ahead and put them in, and I'll be summoned towards the end of the hour, and I'd be happy to ask anything you might have to ask. So Barbara, over to you.
Thank you very much, Patrick. First, I'm going to apologize in case I look wonky. I moved into my library and maybe the signal here isn't as good as it could be, but this isn't about me, so you won't really care if I disappear or grow another head. I'm really pleased to see, we're lucky that Lars Kepler, both of them have come to visit us at the Poison Pen and actually survived terrible temperatures. But today they're home in Stockholm, and Brad Thor is joining us from an undisclosed location in the middle of the United States. So what more could we ask? Anyway, Juna Linda is a fascinating character. And I do have one question for you before I turn this over to Brad, which is, does Sweden actually have as high a rate of serial killers at work as one might think, reading books from Swedish authors?
Well, in our imaginations. No, but actually it's a very good story, you know, trying to understand the criminal mind through one person, one psyche in a way. Mm. So I think that is why so many authors are drawn into the story of serial killers. And it's also kind of very scary, and we want to understand it.
But as you see, in Sweden, it's very, very uncommon with serial killers. Mm-hmm. We had a few through the history, so.
I just thought I'd set the record straight, because one could think that there was a bigger population that might actually exist. So this is the eighth book in this wonderful series, and Brad, I'm going to sit back and blur my face and leave this to you.
All right, thank you, Barbara. Alexandra, it is so wonderful. I have been really looking forward to this because, as you know, I blurbed the book, and I don't blurb books that I don't absolutely love. And for all of you who are watching this, whether it's on Facebook or YouTube, this book is not only chilling, but it is so beautifully written. I'm pointing at my screen. I don't know where they are on your screen. I've got all these boxes. But these two are such incredible, incredible authors. And this book does go dark in places, but it goes dark for a reason. And it's so fascinating. And this was my first book of theirs that I read, and it made me want to go all the way back. Although I understand you don't have to read the books in order. You can start with this one, with The Mirror Man, correct? And then go back. Okay. So the main character, do we say Juna? Is that how you would pronounce his name in Sweden?
Juna. We say Juna.
Juna.
It's the same name.
As in the Bible.
Yeah.
Okay.
Prophet in the Bible who is swallowed, you know, by the big whale fish.
This is just actually the Finnish spelling of Juna.
So it's the same name. Yeah.
Okay, so Jonah. So we'll refer to him as Jonah. So this is, I have to ask you this. Do you have any children?
Yes. We have three children.
Yeah.
Three. That is why we are so scared.
Three daughters.
Okay, I have two children, so it was terrifying for me. For any of you out there watching who read, Barbara, I think it was just this last summer, the book was called The Chain. And it was referred to as Jaws for parents, where your child gets kidnapped and you only can get your child back if you do a despicable act on someone else's child. If you liked that book, if you just somewhat liked it, you are going to love The Mirror Man. So my challenge here is not to give out any, I could spend an hour telling you how awesome the book is, but I'm going to try not to give any spoilers. It's just so damn good. So I have to start out by asking both of you, what drew you to this genre? You were both authors before you started writing together, right? And is this series the first, you go all the way back to The Hypnotist was book number one with Jonah, right? Yes. Was that the first book you wrote together?
Absolutely, yes. And it came from a desire to write together because, as you know, writing is a very lonely job. You have to be there in your story, and we were just very much enjoying doing things together.
We love each other. So we thought, as we both were writers, let's write together. But, you know, it's not that easy. So it started with a lot of fights, actually, arguments. So our first idea was actually to write a children's book, because our children were small by then, and we read a lot
to them. So we thought that writing a children's book together must be very easy.
Yeah, and a good start.
But then we started to fight, and we couldn't merge our different styles. It was impossible. So then after that, we tried to write a play together for the theater, because I used to be an actress, and Alexander has written a lot of plays, but it was even worse. I mean, it was almost divorced. Okay, I am exaggerating, sorry, but a little bit.
Yeah.
Then we understood we had to leave our egos behind. We had to invent a third author that was free from Alexander and Alexandra in a way.
So that was actually the key. We managed to trick ourselves in some way to write together when we had this third author, Lars Kepper. And the strange thing is that Lars Kepper came with
these stories,
the dark stories.
With this genre, he had this genre. So it just happened. And he had also Jonah Linna. Mm. Everything was there. But we have always loved crime fiction.
Yeah, it's a big tradition in Scandinavia, as you probably know. So we had read a lot, but we had never thought about writing crime fiction. So it just came with the name, Lars Kepler.
And it was such a fantastic thing to just step into this genre, because it has everything. And I feel it's a very democratic genre as well, because you can write about all the layers in the society, and it's also read by a whole the society. So I feel it's kind of a unique genre.
Yeah,
so you can discuss here and now.
Modern, contemporary.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. I'm going to ask two questions. I'm going to say something, then I'm going to ask a question, because I want to let our audience know what this particular book is about. I take it for granted. I know what it's about because I was so fortunate to be able to read an early copy. But I want to pay you another compliment, and then I'll ask you a question. The compliment is you have one of the best websites for authors I have ever seen. And I'm very proud of my own, but I think your website, and all of you that are watching, wait until we're done here and then go check out the Lars Kepler website, because it's fantastic. And what's fascinating to me is you had a certain amount of mystery and celebrity mystery. I love the story about how you got your first massive book deal. It was being sold around the world and nobody knew who Lars Kepler was. And there was a reward in Sweden to track you down. And when you tell the story, you tell it so well. When I read it on your website, it felt like I was inside a crime story. I didn't know what was gonna happen because there was a light in the garden. Someone had a flashlight and you were hiding there with your children. You had to run away from your home and hide. So after this is all over and you all have had a chance to ask questions, I really encourage you to look at the Lars Kepler website. Now, you've been on tour for this book for how long now?
Oh, being on tour is a strange word in these days, because we are just sitting at home by our computers, just like when you write. Because I have always loved the two sides of being a writer. One that is very introvert, and the other, when you finally meet the readers, we meet you, we meet Barbara, but in these days, things are different.
Yeah.
So I don't feel like it's a tour. I miss meeting readers. I miss my readers so much.
Yeah,
I do too. I tell people that I don't work for the publisher. I work for the readers.
Yes.
Because the readers are my employers. They are my bosses. Without them, I have no job.
No, and they are the best.
Yeah.
They are the best. Best bosses you could ever hope to work for. So for all of your current bosses and new potential bosses who are watching this, I asked the question about tour because I find that if I've been on doing enough Zooms, asked enough questions about my latest book, I'm often, as the author, the best one to say, this is the story without giving too much away. So I can read the description of the story, but I would almost like you, could you tell us, what is this particular installment of the Killer Instinct series, The Mirror Man, what's it about?
Of course, it's hard to talk about it without spoiling. So we have to try to say something.
Yeah,
but it's it follows John Alina as he tracks down a serial killer targeting young women. So it all begins when she's 16 years old. So 16 years old, Jenny Lind is kidnapped in broad daylight. This case captures national attention, but after a while, the case goes cold.
Yes, and then 5 years later, Jenny's body is found hanging on a playground in Stockholm City. Joan Alina discovers a connection between this homicide and a death declared suicide years before. And then when another young woman goes missing, he understands that they are dealing with a serial killer.
And it's a really complicated and like a psychologically complex story.
Yes, and
it's a labyrinth.
And when we wrote The Mirror Man, actually, it was so intense sometimes that we had to leave our computers.
Yeah, take a break. Yes,
yeah,
go away.
Just go away. And because we are, to us, I think we write these stories not because we like violence, but because we hate violence.
We're afraid.
We are afraid. And so we always use our own fear. And I think The Mirror Man was kind of,
maybe the darkest book we've written so far.
It has gotten some fantastic reviews, though. And the reviews that I put the most value in are from your readers, your bosses, who have read all of the books. And there's a particular review that I saw that said they thought this was probably the best one in your series yet, which is a very difficult thing to do as an author, to be writing a series character and to actually have fans say, best one ever. So for those of you who haven't had a chance to read the book yet, understand that other readers who are well-versed in Jonah and the Lars Kepler Killer Instinct series absolutely love this book. And as we said earlier, you don't have to go back to the beginning. You can start with this one. Let's talk about Jonah for a few minutes, because I found myself saying something and wanting to say this to you, because I get this all the time from my readers. How mean are you to Jonah? How incredibly evil. This poor man has been through so much pain, so much loss. Talk to me a little bit about, so people can understand where Jonah works, and does his pain represent anything for you, either personally, or does it represent something in society? Talk to me a little bit about Jonah, please.
You're absolutely right. Sometimes I really, it's hard because we consider Jonah as a friend, and yet we put him through this horrible thing.
Push him harder and harder. So he's not just smart, Jonah. He's a detective inspector in Stockholm, but he's not just a smart policeman. He also has this ability to see beyond the serial killers as a monster. He can understand and feel their fear and understand the choices they make. And I think he has this empathy that is the key for him as an investigator.
But also for each case he solves, he has this feeling that he's soul is getting a bit darker. And he has this feeling that maybe I'm not making the world a better place anymore. And so he has this complicated...
This has actually started with the recent books, because in the beginning he was a very stubborn hero.
And more secure.
Yeah, and very skilled. But he's becoming more and more complicated. Yeah. And it's strange because we thought that The Mirror Man, it's our eighth book in this series, but we are more curious than ever on who is Jonah Linna? Why is he so complicated? He is so mysterious. We want to know more about him. And I think that is why we enjoy writing about him so much.
He keeps his secrets to us. We should know, but we don't.
I think that's what makes the writing interesting, is if you're curious as the author, your readers will be curious too. And the things you're learning about Jonah are things we, as your readers, want to learn. Jonah's daughter, is her name pronounced Lumi?
Lumi, yes.
Lumi. Does she function a little bit as Jonah's conscience, her concerns about it? Give me a couple of just sentences about Lumi. Tell me a little bit about his daughter.
Yes.
We can hear that you're a writer, because this is absolutely right, of course.
Absolutely. So it's hard to say, but okay. So he had to live without his family for many years. And he has done everything to be with Lumi. And then when they finally are able to get together, it's much more complicated than he would ever imagine.
Yeah, he sacrificed half his life to save her, but
she doesn't know that. It's a kind of, but she is like he. She's also very stubborn and
She's Swedish.
She's Swedish.
We joke in my family that Swedes can be very stubborn. Since I'm Swedish, be very stubborn, and we can hold a grudge for a long time. We smile, but we don't forget. I have a question. There is a character from, we talked about The Hypnotist, your very first book, that it appears several times in The Mirror Man. Of course, I'm talking about, do you pronounce his whole name, Eric Maria Bark?
Yes.
Okay. So Bark is a, for those of you who haven't read any of the Lars Kepler books yet, Bark is a fan favorite. So when Bark comes back, readers get happy. They like seeing him. He's a hypnotist. Do you bring Bark back, or did you include Bark in this book because it was absolutely necessary? Or I hear from my readers, they have certain characters they love. And if I fail to bring that character back in the next book, they get upset, even though it's, I bring back my protagonist, but people have their favorites. So do you find that happens with your readers? They want to see Bark, or is it just, we love the Bark character and he has to be in this?
I think the story calls for Bark.
Yeah,
so I think for us with The Mirror Man, it was the story that, we have to bring back the hypnotist.
Yeah, but if we write a book without him, we can notice that we start to long for him.
Yes.
We want him back because he's complicated and it's...
Yeah. He's very charming.
And it's interesting with his skills, because for him, hypnosis is like an addiction. He needs it.
And the good thing with writing a series is that you never have to say farewell to any character. You know that you can always meet them in the next book. And that is a very good thing. Maybe one book they don't fit there, but in the next book they will have their place. And that is very satisfying.
Yeah, and it's same with the villains. They can return.
Yes. You mentioned you said something interesting here, and I want to ask you if this is a theme through another particular character in your book. So you mentioned that the hypnosis being like an addiction. Can we talk for a few minutes about Jonah's love interest? Valeria?
Valeria.
Yeah. So she's an addict herself. Does the theme of addiction, whether it's being addicted to your work or to, how does that theme, if at all, play in The Mirror Man?
Oh, the Mirror Man has a lot of different addictions, you can say.
Very different levels.
Absolutely, but it's interesting because people are complicated, and
like Valeria, she's clean now since mm-hmm. many years, but Jonah is. He has this problem. It's like a self-medication. Sometimes he smokes opium, and it's not good for him. But he's making the world worse, he have to just go down and meet his own death in some way.
Yeah, and it fills him with shame.
Yep.
In a way.
And he can't tell the truth to Valeria, of course, because she's clean.
So it was kind of, a way of discussing the complexity of the characters and also in this genre, when you have heroes and villains, we wanted to make it more complicated.
Yeah, so the hero is not just a hero, of course, and
villain is not. There are shadows,
So I think for us, it's more interesting to make a villain a whole human with, you can understand the killer. You don't agree with him, but you can understand. About understanding, I think.
I think also it's about, for us, we didn't want to create a monster and a hero. We wanted to know about the choices. Mm. Why did this happen? Why did you make these choices? And the same goes for the hero in a way, because Jonah becomes lonelier and lonelier.
And they, of course, mirror each other.
Mm-hmm. Like a mirror man.
Like a mirror man. Yeah, I was going to go there, but you said it. You said it for me. I think the way you design, the way you paint these incredible characters with your words is what made the book so enjoyable for me. They were not two-dimensional. There were many layers, many, many dimensions. It's why I said at the beginning of this book, it's so beautifully written. I mean, it is, if I had a short sleeve shirt, we're having the same weather where I am today that you have in Stockholm, exact same temperature. And so normally I would have a short sleeve shirt on and I could show you the hair rising on my arm because just even you talking about Jenny Lind and being kidnapped in broad daylight and her body being then in the future left on the playground, it really chilled me, this book. And I was telling friends about it. And it's hard because I don't want to give away the plot. But I talked a little bit about, I said it was like an extra circle of hell, what the victims had to go through in this place. Yes. And friends of mine were saying, oh, well, was it like this movie or was it like this movie where that happened? And I said, it is so unique and so well drawn, the world in this book, that I can't pick out a movie that I could say it's like this because it's so unique. Where are you with Hollywood or any of that kind of stuff? Either with one of the early, I don't know, you know, books get optioned. Sometimes they get made, they don't get made. It's a constant dance with Hollywood. Are we going to be seeing Jonah either on the small screen or the big screen?
I think so.
Yeah.
But we don't dare to talk about it.
Sure.
I'm so sorry, but it's a dance. And we have been dancing this dance for so many years and the orchestra has become silent.
I'm a professional dancer now. Yes. I'm a professional dancer. I've been dancing for 20 years. Yeah, I can do anything. The tango, I can do it all.
I know.
We have to try to be relaxed. And if it's happened, it's happened.
Yeah, but now it looks I think it looks better than ever right now. But actually, we have said that other times before.
Yeah.
So, but we don't dare to talk about it. But we are very close to something that feels fantastic.
Good, good.
But I got excited.
Yeah, still dancing here. Okay, and you're still dancing, so you gotta get there. Barbara, I've got only a million more questions. Are you or Patrick going to give me the signal when it's time to take audience questions?
We can do that. But you know what? Listening to this, I'm going to ask Brad a question, which it has never previously occurred to me to ask him. It's been our privilege to talk with Brad early with these Scott Harbath books for many years. And when he did Black Ice last summer, which I think is a wonderful book in the 20th Scott Harbath, there's a relationship cemented with a Norwegian lady. And never before, Brad, has it occurred to me to ask you, why isn't she Swedish?
Because Sweden is half pregnant with the United States. They have one foot that's kind of in NATO and another foot that is not in NATO. And for me to make the cooperation and the plot work, I had to do it with Norway because they are a full NATO member and the US places a lot of military equipment in a cave complex in Norway. So that's why. I have lots of Swedish friends that have asked me that same question. So excellent question. Why does my protagonist end up with a Norwegian woman instead of a Swedish woman? That's why.
So politics can actually determine choice of characters in a thriller, which is something for you all to think about, especially if you are perhaps new writers. I'm enthralled. Otherwise, no, to carry on, and we're not under any time constraint. And whenever you feel like you've run out of questions, then Patrick will magically appear in his box and talk to the audience. But don't feel any time pressure, Brad. We're fine.
Okay. Well, I talked about my favorite characters in the book. There's one serial killer that really scares Jonah, that Jonah is really, really afraid of. Can you tell me a little bit about your research for all of your villains? I'm obviously super intrigued and was very inspired as a writer to see how you humanize all of the characters, regardless of why they're doing what they're doing. We definitely understand them, including some very deeply disturbed people. What kind of research did you do into the criminal mind? Or is it all just inspiration?
No, we do a lot. We do a huge amount of research because authenticity is very important for us. And I think it's very important for this genre that we need to have one leg in absolute police tactics and forensics and everything. So we do that. We visit crime scenes. We visit maximum security prisons. We talk to witness experts
psychologists, criminologists. And of course, we read a lot about serial killers, real cases. But I think that's maybe the hardest part of being a crime fiction writer is some of the research, because then you'd read about or you meet real victims and meet real suffering. And well, it's necessary, of course, but it's heavy and it's not entertaining because in fiction, you can make the world okay again. You can stop the villain. You can save the one you care about.
Yeah, but you go to a journey from questions to answers.
From chaos to order and so forth.
And that is kind of the entertaining and lustful part of crime fiction.
But when you read about real serial killers, it's just horrible. It's just suffering, it's loneliness, it's a lack of love.
Lack of mercy.
It's hard. I think
the pain of the families as they lose, whether it's children or wives or husbands, spouses, the people who survive and what they go through and the torture of imagining what happened, even with the fictional characters in your book, just the devastation. We talked about we're all parents and how that would feel. And that's particularly why the hair's up on my arms again. Again, for any of you who are just tuning in, I got the chance to read this book early on, and I was a huge fan of the book called The Chain, which is a great psychological thriller for parents. And I was saying at the beginning that if you liked that book, you were going to love The Mirror Man. It's just so good. There's a certain amount of restraint in your writing that I really admire. Everything, there was no fat I don't know what your manuscript, there was nothing to trim off. It was so, it was all muscle and bone. I don't know what your first draft looks like that you go to your editor with, because there was nothing I would have changed in this book. I mean, I love the police raids. As a thriller writer, I love that stuff. You get the tactical things right. Let's pull the camera back, if you will. I'd like to talk about your writing process. Do you write together? Do you write separately? Do you trade off chapters? Tell us how this works for a husband and wife team, Lars Kepler, to write a novel.
Well, yeah, we share everything in the writing process from the first idea and forward. But it all starts with a plot.
Yeah.
We need to have a plot that we make very detailed.
So we do, like a lot of screenplay writers, we put every scene on a little piece of paper, you know, a key scene, and then we hang the piece of papers on the wall so we can overview the story, and then we take a step back and dream up the story together. Mm-hmm. We write new notes and move the pieces of paper around on the wall and discuss, mm-hmm. and this continues for at least a month.
Yeah, until we feel that we have an total understanding of the plot.
Yeah.
And then
I think it's necessary because we're two writers, yeah, too, so we have to write the same story.
Exactly.
And this might seem disciplined, but as a writer, you know, when you sit down and write, your characters, they don't care about the plot or the notes on the wall. They do what they want to. So it's a fight to keep them on track, but still listening to them. Mm. That's magic of writing, I think.
Yeah, and when we sit by our computers and write, we sit side by side.
A meter away.
And then we write separate scenes, and after a while we change text
with each other. So, and then I get Alexandra's scene and I, you know, edit it, continue it. And sometimes, you know, when I write, I can just hear their voices, the characters' voices. So I sit down and it's because no problem. I know I have Alexandra by my side. So I just put down what they say. I try to.
That's kind of creepy because when Alexandra writes dialogue, he starts to whisper.
Yeah.
And well, that is, I just hear.
I hear them.
It's like the exorcist or something.
Well, when they talk and I write. So, and then I email my dialogue to Alexandra, and half an hour later, I get it back, and suddenly they have faces, bodies, clothes. They are moving through deep snow or something. Wow, it's come alive. And then I add maybe some complications in the situations, and I email it back to Alexandra, and she continues. We continue like this.
Yeah, and I think when the book is finished, there is not a single sentence in it that just one of us has written alone. Yeah. It's kind of the tone of Lars Kepler. Mm. So, yeah.
It's a very creative
we write the text again and again, and we edit it together at the same time. As you said about editing, I think that is why we look at the text very, we are in the text, but we can also, you know, look at it with the cold eyes in a way.
Since you naturally, when you exchange text in this way, you get new input all the time. So in one way, you push each other to be top on, like a top inspiration all the time. So, because when you feel a dip, you just mail your text to your wife. You get it back.
Okay. Brad, may I ask a question?
Sure.
Okay. I mean, clearly when you're done, you've written a third voice. You've created a third voice that is not yours, either one of you. But my question is, when you were writing separately, before you started writing together, did you do that kind of plotting? I understand why you would need to map out a book if you're going to both work on it, so you're both writing the same story. But when you were writing your own stories, did you work differently?
Yes,
totally.
Yeah. I wrote historical novels, so it was totally different. And I wrote much more on intuition in a way, not like this. Totally different genre.
Yeah, I agree. It was just like follow your inspiration and try to make the best of it. But for us, this is more creative to work like this.
It's more of a challenge, actually, much more of a challenge.
To write crime fiction.
Yes.
So for those of you who are watching right now, this was such a fun interview talk for me to prepare for, because as I've said, I got to read the book, but I got to do a dive into their backgrounds and read critical acclaim and things like this. And one novelist kept coming up that they were being compared to. And I have to agree, and I would put them at this level. If you enjoyed any of the Thomas Harris books, Silence of the Lambs, any of those, you will love their writing. I mean, it is that good. And I know sometimes it's hard, to find a new writer that you like, but Alexander and Alexandra have done something. It's over 15 million books worldwide. I think you're in what? Oh, you've been translated into just tons of, that's a good question. When you write, I assume you write in Swedish.
Yep. Yes. Yes.
Okay. So when I read this book, the translation must have been fantastic, because in English, it was so good. So for you to be able to write this well via a translator really speaks to your talent, also speaks to the talent of the translator. Do you have any input? Have you used the same translator, or is that up to the publisher who publishes you in English and all the other languages?
Yeah, that's a great question again. We are so grateful for what you say, Brad. You are very generous.
I loved it. I would not be, I'm writing a new book right now. This is an hour of my life that's very valuable, but I wouldn't have missed this for anything. That's how much I love the Mirror Man.
So. And you have to come to Stockholm. You have to come to Stockholm.
That was the last trip I took before COVID. I brought my father to Stockholm. So he it was a really nice trip, but we can't wait to come back.
Yeah. Please contact us.
It'll be my pleasure. I got to take my dad back to see Värmland. To see the town, the village that
fantastic.
We're from.
It's so funny.
Nykroppa, he's never seen it. I've been there, but he's never been. So do you get a say with the translator? You're allowed to select
who you
want?
Back to the question. Absolutely. No, we don't get to choose the translator. Our publishers do that.
But we work very closely with our publisher in the US.
Especially in the US, because it has been just a great cooperation, and we have been very much involved in the editing process.
Of course, it's special because we can read English.
Yeah.
And my French is bad, and my Japanese is lousy.
Even worse. Yeah.
But English, we can see that it's very close to the original, and that feels good.
Yeah. And we have also been so happy that our American publishing house has welcomed us so much in the process.
Yeah.
And so we have felt very confident in this. Otherwise, we just have to trust the professionalism in the publishing houses around the world.
Yeah.
Well, I remember things right. You actually, this is your, I think I'm right here, this your second American publisher, right?
Yes.
Right. And so, if I also remember right, weren't the books retranslated? The early books, didn't Knopf, your current publisher, redo them? So if any of you might have read The Hypnotist, for example, when it first appeared in the United States, there is a new edition of it with a new translation. And I don't remember, is it three books I think that was true of, or was it four?
Yes,
three books before Knopf. So they might, I don't know how much different they are, but what is good with Knopf was that they remade all the books, so they have now some kind of coherent tone.
Right. I mention it because, if somebody, it'd be an interesting thing if you're really, a fan of this sort of thing, if you happen to have bought or owned The Hypnotist or the other two books in their original American edition, it would be interesting for you to go back and read the new one and see what the differences are. They may be very subtle, But you know, a different translator is clearly going to produce a different. You know, the whole book will be different. And I think we first did an event with you for the first book that you did with Knopf, and then we had to wait for the retranslated books to come out. I think that's why I can remember it so clearly, is that people would ask, you know, well, can we get the hymn? And we'd have to say, no, not quite yet. You know, it's going to be coming out. But that's such an interesting question, Brad, about translators. And we did an event for, who was it? Another Swedish author, Camilla Läckberg, that's who it was. And it turned out, amazingly, that I got an email before she came to the store from a man I went to Stanford with. He was in my class, 1962. And he wrote and said, they lived in New Mexico, that he and his wife would like to come to the event, and could we make time for them to talk to Camilla? And I thought, well, okay, you know, I don't know why, but sure. And it turned out that his wife was the translator for Camilla's books. And so we ended up doing, in part, an event about how translators work, because, you know, we had a real live translator there with an author. And we learned, you know, translators work on contract. They do not participate in royalties the way, you know, authors do. And then it turned out the husband had translated the Stieg Larsson books, the first three.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, in a way, he didn't get to participate financially in their success because his work was done. You know, yeah. He'd been the translator and all. And so that was the first time I sort of recognized that that how things work in this respect. I hadn't ever really thought about how it would work with translators. So, you know, you should think about that, Brad, because you're published internationally. And so you clearly have translators in other countries. Yeah.
I am
making your English and changing it.
It would be neat to meet them, and I should probably put that on my list of things to do when I travel, to make sure I get to take my translator out for a nice dinner and a nice bottle of wine. Which I have one question that I absolutely have to ask, because I want to ask something that maybe you don't get asked in all of your interviews. So one of the things that I loved about the James Caan, the movie adaptation of Stephen King's book, Misery, I loved it because it was about a writer. I love stories about writers. My wife is a doctor and she will not watch any medical dramas. She hates them because they always get things wrong, and that makes her upset. Yeah. You can't get writers wrong. We're all so different and there's really no rules. But one of my favorite things about the movie Misery is James Caan finishes writing his manuscript and he treats himself to one cigarette and a fantastic bottle of champagne. I have a friend in Nashville who was a songwriter for the Carpenters, and he wrote a lot of their hits. And I was at an event with him and he said, Brad, when you finish your books, what do you do to celebrate? And I said, what do you mean celebrate? And he said, well, when I would finish an album with the Carpenters, he said, I had a sailboat. I would say I was living in California. I would sail out to this island and I would spend one whole week on the boat eating only the food I brought on the boat or what I could take from the ocean. So because so much, I have to imagine so much emotion goes into your writing. You're dealing with so many different things, the pain of the victims, the pain of the protagonist, the pain of the villain. Is there anything that you do to say, okay, now that book is over and you kind of close the door? Is there anything? Do you need to refresh or recharge yourselves before you start the next Killer Instinct book?
Absolutely. When we finish a book, we feel that we gave everything. And we always feel that maybe there will be no more ideas, no more stories.
We
just burned out everything in our imaginations. So, well, usually maybe this is not such a, we don't go by the boat and the fish.
This is not celebrating, actually, but we do the laundry, we do the dishes, everything we neglected before.
Because when we write, when we are finishing a book, it's so intense that we don't do anything at home. We just keep on writing.
Computers.
So when it's finished, we just look around and,
oh, this is a mess.
Yeah, we need to clean the house.
it's
therapeutic.
Yeah, it's a good way to clean your head too.
Yeah.
Okay.
So
well,
we do that
now,
and we then we just have new ideas suddenly.
The International Authors Association is now going to send men with dark glasses and suits to your house because we're supposed to make everybody think we're so glamorous. And we do all these amazing things. You're not supposed to tell the truth.
But it feels good, actually. Feels good to just take care of everything that we neglected. Yeah. Paying the bills again, you know, doing everything that we
neglected. Actually, the writing is a celebration.
Yes.
It's to feel your own inspiration in front of your computer. It's the best.
Yeah, because we really feel that we enjoy writing and writing together so much. It's like that expensive champagne, actually. Yeah. And sometimes we get champagne as well.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Well, I'm sorry we can't offer you a glass. I'm just drinking tea because it's noon or 1 o'clock now here.
I was going to bring some of my bourbon into this, but I thought it's too early in the day. I won't get any writing. I'll write, but it won't be good writing.
When Brad and I talk, we do it in the evening.
It's
and
then we're allowed.
Yeah, we do BYOB. Actually, Brad, thinking ahead to next summer, let's think about a translator. We have not done an event where you might talk briefly, at least for a portion of it, with one of your translators. I think that would be fascinating.
We've got a wide range of people. I think that would be fun. Bring somebody in for a few minutes to chat via Zoom or whatever.
Let's do that. All right. So, Patrick, why don't you pop up in your magical square here and see if we have any comments? Or Patrick usually is full of insightful questions of his very own.
Well, I don't know about that. Thank you. But yes, I do have a question. Can you talk a little bit about the challenges of writing in present tense? Is that have you always done that, or is that a challenge for you, or does it just come naturally?
Interesting question. Mm-hmm. Well, it just actually also just followed Lars Kepler. We have never written in present tense before.
But in our individual books, no.
So it's just happened, and I think it's a tempus of thrillers. You know, it's happening here and now. It's not retelling a case. It's not, let me tell you about what happened last year when I worked as a detective. No, it's happening now. So you don't know if your detective is going to survive 5 minutes more, because it's present tense.
And it's also very filmic, we feel, because we are in the middle of the situation and we wanted the readers to be there as well, you know, feeling like they're actually part of the development.
But the challenge, it's of course a lot of challenges with present tense. It's a lot harder to give the readers an overview because it's like a point of view camera all the time for the characters. So we can't, you know, overview the story.
Which omniscient narrator, right.
If you're a big narrator, can tell you, this is a day when it's going to happen a lot of things. Keep in mind this and this person, he's going to meet in a few hours and all that. You can't do that when you write in present tense. So
it's a more unsecure way of writing. Unsecure is the wrong word, but it's kind of you go to the door, but the readers don't know what will happen when you open the door. I think that was the feeling that we wanted to
thriller movie feeling.
Something is happening here and now, and we don't have the answer.
No, it's fair.
Which we have, of course. But
Brad, have you ever used present tense, Brad? Or are you usually
it's that third person omniscient. You know, one of the only people before I became a writer who I liked who wrote in first person was Nelson DeMille, and I loved his John Corey books because he was such a smart aleck, and I thought. It takes a certain amount of skill as an author I do it the way I do it because I'm comfortable, but I don't know that I would be able to do this in present tense the way that Alexandra and Alexander do. I just think it's just another testament to their skill as writers.
Absolutely. By the way, Brad, you've done a terrific job of hosting. I mean, talk about.
Thank you.
Talk about some great questions.
It was fun for me. I've made two new friends in Sweden. And when I come, we can all go to my favorite. It's a beautiful restaurant right near the water. It's called like Oaxen. I forget the name.
Oaxen. Yeah. It's really nice. A great restaurant.
Yeah. Delicious food. Yeah.
Good choice.
Let's go there.
Yeah. Okay, we'll go there.
Yeah, well, we've had a number of viewers also chiming in to say, you know, good job, Brad. You're doing a great job.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, we have a viewer in Italy, Rosario, who wants to know, in Italy, all the novels of Lars Kepler have had a great following. Have they thought of setting a story here? I don't know how you do that.
Well, why not?
Oh, we'd love to.
Yeah.
Great idea.
But where in Italy? That's the question.
Oh, I love Rome.
Rome, of course. Milan, of course.
Milan, yes.
Yeah.
So absolutely, good idea.
Yep.
Let's think about it.
Okay, I have a question here from one of our Facebook viewers for Brad, but I think it applies for you as well. Let's see, Linda wants to know, she says, question, how much of what you took from your imagination is now the new normal? She's talking about the advent of cell phones completely changing, you know, thriller plots and things like that. How ahead of the curve have you been, I think is what she's asking.
At least for me, I try not to get too far ahead. There's a, for instance, in the book I'm writing right now, there's a new piece of military technology, which would have been awesome to put in this book. They are developing these things that look like jet skis, but have fans. And you can actually, they're like the sky cycles from Star Wars. And they're testing these with the military and things like that. And it was just too far in the future. It would have really disrupted the attention of the reader. And that's really the job, Patrick, is you don't want to trip people up. You want them, there is an agreement between the author and the reader, the suspension of disbelief. If you make mistakes, that shocks the reader out of the story. And in addition to making mistakes, if you put things in that are too unusual, too out of the ordinary, that'll shock the reader out of the story. It breaks the trance. And you've failed at your job. If you break the trance through your writing at any point, you've made a mistake as the author.
Yeah, that's well put.
It is amazing though to see, you know, we watched that crime documentary show First 48, and we were going back, and a great show for anybody who wants to know about crime, but we were going back and watching a season, you know, as recently as, you know, 2009. And there are hardly any cameras out in the streets, you know, and so you watch the police investigating. And of course, you know, 5 years later, that whole public block would have been under, you know, cameras. It completely changes the way investigations are being done now. It's amazing.
It does. And actually, Patrick and I did an event with an author last week where amnesia, a person who'd been in an accident, and the accident, you know, had induced amnesia. And so with no identification, nobody could work out who the woman was. And this went on for years. And, you know, I said, but today that plot is largely being erased. Even if fingerprint technology wouldn't help you much with a national database, there's DNA now that you could submit, you know, to find relatives. And with facial recognition coming along, it would be even more difficult for somebody to remain unidentified for a long time. So I think for all of you, you know, there's a real challenge for thriller writers to stay. You don't want to get too far ahead, as Brad said, but you can't really afford to lag behind unless you deliberately take a time frame. You could, you know, move a book back to the 90s, let's say, and then you wouldn't have to deal with that. But it does seem to me that modern technology is just blowing up a lot of really great plots.
I think writing thrillers and crime fiction is a lot about, you know, stopping cameras. You find a place where there are no cameras on the buildings. You find a way why your cell phone doesn't work in this place, and so forth. So you have to block all those things that destroys your story.
Well, that's true, but you still have to account for it. you can't ignore it, you know, whereas if you were writing earlier, it wouldn't even come into play. And, you know, so there is somewhat of a challenge there, and you have to consciously think about disabling it before you can go anywhere. Was there anything else, Patrick, that you wanted to address?
Yeah, there are a question actually for all three authors. Who are some of your favorite contemporary crime writers or thriller writers? Who do you like to read?
Oh, well, we read everything, yeah. Actually. We even have started a book discussion club, me and Alexander, because we felt that there suddenly was too little time of reading in our lives.
Yes, pleasure reading.
Yeah. So we started to read, but we don't just read crime fiction, we read everything.
Yeah, so we read, of course, all our colleagues in Scandinavia, and then a lot of American writers, of course.
Yeah, well, I like Gillian Flynn very much. There are so many I like. I also like the old ones, you know. I like, I hate to pick one because I am a really hungry reader. I read everything, and reading is a part of my life, and all the writers, it depends on the mood. So sorry, maybe boring answer.
This is what I call the dead author question, because it's so tricky for you to actually pick out anybody given all your colleagues. I mean, whenever I'm asked, you know, I come up with like Dorothy Sayers or something, because there's no way I'm going to alienate all the writers we work with by saying this is my favorite one.
Well, it's like a favorite song or music. It's
favorite food. You don't want to eat meatballs every day.
That's really true. You know what? Readers, I don't think non-readers ever understand why readers have a stack of books they read. You're never entirely sure which book is going to fit you at the moment. You know, I mean, you're just not always up for a particular connection, I'm told, is unstable. So I need to shut up or retire. Wind it up for you.
It's funny, though, because as garbled as it was, we could kind of get the sense of what you were saying.
Yeah.
You know, you're talking about having a big stack, and you need a book for every mood. Basically, that's what you're saying, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now you're back. Okay, good. Brad, how about you?
Listen, I love to read everything. I'm a huge, couple of the Poison Pen favorites. I'm a huge Kyle Mills fan, was a big fan of Kyle Mills before he took over the Vince Flynn books, writing the Mitch Rapp character. Jack Carr is a really good friend of mine, and I love Jack's books. And a Phoenix native named Pung Shepherd. She wrote a fabulous book called The Book of M, and her new book is coming out. It's going to be called The Cartographers, and I got to read an advanced copy of that. I think Pung is just an amazing, amazing writer, and her mom is a longtime newscaster there in the Phoenix market.
Yeah.
And she will appear at the Poison Pen on March 30th. I'm happy to
say. Hey, I'll put that in my calendar. I look forward to watching that.
Great. Let's see. Anything else here coming in? Okay. Not really. Everybody just saying, you know, a lot of people are just saying we love your work. A lot of Brad fans, a lot of Lars fans. Thanks everybody for tuning in. This is great.
Yeah, it was wonderful. And thank you for such a great book. Folks, you're going to love this book. I really, really mean it. And this was a nice step outside of my comfort zone. This is not the genre that I read a lot. And now I'm a rabid fan. Now I can't wait to read all of the other books that they've done and have been translated, because my Swedish is so bad. It's got to be in English. My French is pretty good, but my Swedish, I'm an embarrassment to my family. I got to work on it.
Better than ours.
You were good.
Yeah.
Actually, I do have one interesting question. One interesting question that just came in, which is probably a good one to wind up on. Anne wants to know, what is the one place you'd like to set a novel, where you'd like to set a novel, but you would never go?
Oh.
That's a hard one.
Cincinnati. No, just kidding.
Do you have an answer? You're much better than us in answering.
You know what? I was a travel journalist before I became an author. There really is no place that I wouldn't go. So, Anne, it's a great question. But if I told you that there's a place I would set a novel, but I don't ever want to go there, that means I relied on someone else's attitude and opinions about visiting a place. I've been to Afghanistan. My goodness. I went to Afghanistan during the war to actually spend time over there and get to know it a little bit for a book. So I think that's a hard question. I don't know any place I would not go. Maybe Sacramento. Sacramento, I don't ever need to go back to. Even Jim Rollins moved out of Sacramento eventually. So if Jim Rollins, it isn't good enough for Jim Rollins, I'm kidding. Sacramento's a fine, fine place. But no, I got to get all the hate mail from Sacramento, California. No, I there's no place I would set a book in that I wouldn't want to go to. I wish we didn't have COVID now and everything was open. It would be lovely.
Maybe space. I don't want to go to the moon or something. I prefer to stay on the Earth.
I agree. Yeah. So space is the word.
Yeah. That's a great answer. Yeah.
Great answer.
Stay grounded.
Well, thank you, everybody. I don't know if you can hear me, but in case you can.
Yeah. Crystal clear now.
Thank you very, very much. It's a fabulous hour, and I really want to recommend this to people who might want to write as well for writers. Patrick, if you can't hear me, you can translate that.
No, we heard you. We heard that. Yeah.
Oh, good. Okay. Well, in that case, bye, everybody.
Thanks for tuning in, everybody.
Thank you so much. Great to meet you.
Yes. Pleasure. Nice meeting you, too. Bye, everybody.
Bye, everybody.
Thanks, Brad.
Thank you, Patrick.
Take care, guys.
Bye. Hey,
bye. Bye.
Thank you.
See you in Stockholm.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.